Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Climate change is one of the great challenges of our time. Some Republicans, including the current occupant of the White House, are trying to reverse progress made addressing climate change. Trump wants to renege on U.S. pledges to the Paris Climate Agreement, remove regulations on coal emissions, and weaken or eliminate the Environmental Protection Agency. Last week, the president signed an executive order rolling back the Clean Power Plan, President Obama's key measure to fight climate change by limiting carbon emissions from power plants and requiring states to cut overall emissions. We should fight these moves by the Trump administration and Republican Congress and see them as a call to action for all citizens. But despite these obstacles, strong action by leaders in government, business, and communities continue to address climate change and protect our environment. Some local and state leaders are carrying forward with plans to cut carbon emissions and shift from fossil fuels like coal and oil to renewable energy. About 30 states have set standards requiring power companies to sharply increase their use of renewable energy. Some states like California and Illinois are requiring serious cuts in the greenhouse gas emissions. And while the coal industry employs about 65,000 people, the renewable energy industry employs 10 times as many workers, about 650,000 jobs and growing. The move to renewable energy is unstoppable. Nowhere is the battle against climate change more intense than in southern Florida, where rising sea levels are already regularly flooding coastal areas. Billions of homes and businesses' value are threatened by the rising sea. Our guest today is one of the champions on the front lines of addressing climate change in southern Florida. Jennifer Gerardo is the director of the Environmental Protection and Growth Management Department for Broward County, Florida. Jennifer Gerardo, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So we met 2 weeks ago at the Rachel's Network gathering, Women Committed to the Environment and Women's Leadership, and you blew me away with how brilliant you are, how well-informed you are, and how committed you are to dealing with the climate change and the rising seas in South Florida. So thank you for the great work you're doing.
Well, thank you for the opportunity and your interest in sharing these issues with the audience today.
So can you tell our listeners what is actually happening in the communities there now? I was actually a little shocked at how advanced the rising seas are in affecting communities already in South Florida. So tell us what the communities there are facing.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've measured regionally 9 inches of sea level rise since the early 1900s. And for many other parts of the nation and shorelines, perhaps 9 inches wouldn't have as dramatic impacts as it does here. But we have a very flat and low-lying landscape and very intense urban development. So these minor changes in sea level are quite significant when we consider that a lot of the infrastructure in our region was built around the 1950s or so, and much of this rise has occurred since the infrastructure has been designed. And as a result, we have, especially in the last 10 years, begun to experience quite significant, severe, and prolonged tidal flooding that occurs throughout the fall season during the periods of peak tides that really has dramatic impacts on our communities. What was once considered what we call nuisance flooding that might occur for a day in a month or a couple of times a year can now occur for, say, 30 days in a year, inundating neighborhoods with more than a foot of salt water that extends across entire roadways, disrupting traffic, disrupting commerce, killing the landscaping, damaging vehicles, isolating people in their residences or in their places of work, and really just having very dramatic implications for services and quality of life. And this is very dramatic down in the Florida Keys, very impactful in the Miami Beach area. Several communities in my county and here in Broward are considered to be quite vulnerable. So it's really in the last several years quite awakening for residents and business leaders and elected officials who've been attuned to these issues, but there's a growing demand for resources to be aligned to help address the flooding.
Yeah, that's a great description of it. And as some of the pictures, I wish our listeners could see them, but maybe they can find them on the internet. But actually seeing the flood waters, just the sea, like you said, you know, used to be a nuisance flooding or occasional. Now it's happening pretty frequently. You're getting water across the roads, so roads become impassable. They're damaging the vehicles, like you mentioned, the cars and people's homes. And you know, I don't know what the number is, but it's got to be in the billions of dollars. That's such a heavily, heavy concentration of people living there, of businesses operating there. Do you have any idea, like, the scale of how much is at risk given this rising sea level flooding?
Well, with 1 foot of sea level rise, it is heavily conservatively estimated at $3 billion, and that's not including the figures for Miami-Dade County. Those were not included in the initial estimates that we arrived at. With 3 feet of sea level rise, still heavily conservative at $6 billion in taxable infrastructure. And the reason that that's a very conservative number is it only takes into account elevation and the value of the property at a presumed impacted level of seas rise. But the situation is much, much more complex than that for us here because the water doesn't just spill over the landscape. The seas are actually rising beneath our feet. We have a very porous geology. And so as sea level rises 1 foot, the coastal groundwater elevations are rising a foot as well. We're losing storage in the geology that is critical when it rains. The soils store a lot of water, and as you lose capacity in the soils, that water now floods the landscape. In addition, the entire water management and drainage system from the region east to west is a part of a complex canal network, and the ability to drain any of rainfall from the landscape is contingent upon water being able to run downstream or downslope and empty into the coastal waters. And as seas rise, that gradient is reduced and the discharge capacity is reduced. So as a result, communities that are maybe at a higher elevation or much further inland are also experiencing flooding associated with rising seas, even though they're not part of the waterfront. So, again, those numbers are very, very conservative, and we're just now undertaking the much more complex hydrologic modeling that will begin to tell a more complete story.
Right. And so you mentioned there the 1 foot rise. Like, how long are they thinking it's going to take to have the sea level rise a foot?
We're planning for about a foot of rise by about 2035. We're planning for a full 2 feet of sea level rise by 2050. We are organizing our planning efforts around an estimated 2 feet of sea level rise, as I said, in the 2050-2060 timeframe. And we consider that to be quite reasonable given the nature of planning and investments that's required. We have to take that into account. And the trajectory when we look at emissions and its influence on warming and thermal expansion of the oceans and ice melt, those projections are never decreasing. They're always increasing. And so I think we've estimated that the practical consideration is to assume 2 feet. And if we're fortunate enough that it takes an additional 10 years before that that rise actually occurs, nonetheless, it's still part of what's already baked into the system, and we do need to prepare for it.
Absolutely, because we're not going to be reversing climate change anytime soon. It just, you're right, every time they come out with an estimate, it's always worse than what we thought it was going to be. And you're talking, even with your very conservative numbers, that within about 18 years, by 2035, would see that 1 foot sea level rise. And you're saying that's affecting at least $3 billion worth of property plus the Miami area. this is like major people's lives. This is like one of the most concentrated living areas, I think, in the country. And it has to be one of the greatest at-risk places in the world. And when you think about sea level rising, now I know there's some islands out there which could be completely covered and we lose them, but this has certainly got to be one of the top places in the world where we're feeling the impact of the sea rise from the climate change right now. Is that true? Like, where does Southern Florida fit in terms of the global picture of impact on climate change?
Well, we are one of the most vulnerable areas in the nation. I mean, clearly there are low-lying islands and other communities, and you know, China also has great vulnerabilities to sea level rise, and areas of India, and you know, so there are clearly other areas. But what makes our region somewhat unique, and the rate of rise can even be higher in other areas because perhaps they're subsiding, and so they're realizing a rate that's accelerated. But we have the unique fortune of having such a concentration, as you said, of really high concentration of population and valuable real estate. So the economic implications of unmitigated sea level rise are quite significant. Our four counties of Palm Beach, Broward, Miami-Dade, and Monroe, which constitute Southeast Florida, have a population of about 6 million. We make up collectively one-third of our state's gross domestic product by way of economic activity. And Florida's economic output is the fourth largest of the states in our nation. So there are dramatic economic consequences, not just for our region and not just for our state, but for our nation. And then when you take into account that coastal counties account for nearly 50% of our state's GDP, there is a national interest and what happens to the economies of coastal communities if we choose not to invest in resilient infrastructure and mitigation measures that can help rein in and harness the rate of future rise. When we think about all the educational services and the health services and the infrastructure that is supported by economies that line our coastlines, it is a national imperative that we organize the resources. Otherwise, climate impacts that may be further out in the future or even realized today in areas that have agricultural interests, there won't be the resources to address those impacts either because they'll be so intimately connected to the resources that are derived from the coastal economies.
Yeah, that's a very dramatic situation. I think it's very accurate. We have got to address this whole situation. And I am so impressed with what you're doing. So tell us a little bit about you. You're really a champion on the rising sea levels for our coastal communities. What's the mission of your department? What are you doing to deal with this onslaught? We're not talking like 50 years from now. We're saying right now there's rising sea level that's damaging homes, it's damaging roads, it's damaging cars, it's damaging businesses and hotels that are on the coast of South Florida. What are you doing about it? What can be done?
Well, within our agency, we're charged with the resiliency initiatives that are specific to our county operations, that are shared initiatives with our 31 municipalities that are part of Broward County. And we're also partners in what we refer to as the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Change Compact. The four counties I mentioned came together in 2010, and we've been formally addressing shared climate mitigation and adaptation challenges at the regional level since that time. Our work involves water resource policy planning and management, shoreline protection, environmental monitoring, energy and sustainability, urban and natural areas, lands, coral reef conservation, a broad array of environmental initiatives, but then also focused on the integration of urban and natural systems. We have a very strong history of collaboration with many of our federal agencies, and we would not be so well armed to take these issues at hand if it weren't for our work with the United States Geologic Service. We have, for more than a decade, worked to develop very advanced hydrologic models that do allow us to understand how sea level rise will impact our geology, our hydrology. And as a result, we're undertaking pretty, I think, dramatic and forward-thinking changes in our regulatory process where we're formally planning for future flood conditions. And in fact, we're right now going through the process of amending what is in our code of ordinances to require that drainage infrastructure will have to be designed with the future flood condition in mind, and not in mind. I mean, it's part of formal maps. So our mapping of 2 feet of sea level rise and how we have to organize infrastructure around that condition. We're also undertaking a process of updating our flood, they're called the finished floor elevations, the lowest elevation of a floor for residential and commercial buildings for flood conditions with 2 feet of sea level rise. So those are fairly progressive. We're also working with the Army Corps of Engineers to undertake advanced modeling that combines analyses of future sea level rise and high tides and storm events. So all the, you know, the combination of conditions that contribute to flooding, organizing that around the 2 foot sea level rise scenario as well, so that we can come up with regional top elevations for seawalls. Basically, the idea is that we need to keep as much water out of the landscape as possible. We need to install infrastructure, namely in the way of pumps and valves that prevent backflow of water through our storm systems to block and manage the water that would otherwise come in. And we need to elevate infrastructure where, because of our geology, water will undoubtedly begin to occupy more of the landscape. And I think that those engineering solutions, those design strategies, building resiliency into the landscape, we can probably manage pretty well with 2 to 3 feet of sea level rise, recognizing, however, that there will be areas that will probably deem too challenging or too costly to be able to mitigate the floodwaters entirely. But those areas, I think, will be identified over the coming decades, and our efforts, though, will be focused on trying to preserve what we can, and at the same time looking for forward-thinking national policy and state policy and local initiatives that can be more aggressive on renewable energies and see if we can't begin to literally turn the tide.
Oh, I love that, turn the tide. That's fantastic. Well, and just to be clear for our listeners here, what you're talking about with the sea level rise, the flooding is not happening when there is a major storm or a flood or a hurricane. We're talking about just on your regular average, you know, high tide day that now there's flooding that's happening. So it's encouraging that you think you can manage it up to 2 to 3 feet rise if you keep on your current track. But the other thing, which we haven't really mentioned much at all, is as the saltwater sea level rises, how that impacts the freshwater supply for southern Florida. So I would think, you know, any of the underwater tables could easily get the salination, the salt in them, and then make it undrinkable. What's the risk there in terms of the drinking water supply for South Florida?
Well, that's a very real risk. And in fact, we've been managing saltwater intrusion within the aquifer for decades. Saltwater intrusion has been a problem simply because we have drained so much of the landscape in order for the urban population to exist here. If had it not been drained, we'd be flooded all the time. We're occupying area that was previously part of the Florida Everglades. So we've dramatically changed the hydrology of the region, and as a result, saltwater intrusion has historically been an issue. However, the regional policy has prevented any additional withdrawals from the aquifer since 2006, withdrawals above historic rates. So the saltwater intrusion that will occur with time will be driven by sea level rise. There we've worked with, the USGS, to model the relative contributions of land use and changes in well field operations and sea level rise, the variety of factors to understand how much of an influence is sea level rise on saltwater intrusion. And what we've learned is that the rate of rise to date has accelerated by a factor of 2, the landward movement of the front. And in looking at the coming decades, by 2060, again, with 2 feet of sea level rise, we expect to lose about 40% of our coastal well field capacity. That's equivalent to about 35 million gallons per day in potable water supply that we need today. That's not even accounting for future populations. So it requires some forward thinking about our aggressive conservation initiatives, which we do have in place. Developing alternative water supplies, such as reclaimed water, moving well fields, harvesting storm water for reuse is another potential that is being developed. But we do need to be cognizant that as we move to alternative water supplies, all of those will require higher levels of treatment, hence energy, than our current water treatment technologies. And that is not entirely consistent with what we're seeking to achieve with emissions reductions. And, you know, the treatment and movement of water is one of the most energy-intensive demands on the grid. And we need to be very thoughtful and also seek advancements in the efficiencies of those technologies as water management becomes more difficult in the ensuing years.
Right. Did I hear you correctly? You said by the year 2060 that you expect to lose about 40% of the current fresh water supply?
Of the coastal well fields, it's about 16% of, if we talk about Broward County, it's about 16% of all of our water capacity, but it's 40% of the coastal. And the reason that there is a distinction there, we have very distinct treatment facilities and water quality from west to east. And so treatment facilities that are treating water from the east today are not the same facilities that can treat water in the future. So there's a very, distinct infrastructure considerations that are at hand.
Right. Well, you're doing an amazing job, and it's, you know, very serious threat, and, you know, something, not just a threat, it's happening now and will definitely intensify. And I have to ask you, because I wondered it when I was down there, given the intensity of the sea level rise and given how low level South Florida is, and given the vulnerability of the water supply, do you think we're really going to be able to save the coastal communities of Southern Florida, or is it already too late?
Well, I think that over time there will be concessions that will very likely be made in some of the most vulnerable areas. I think that we will find that there are certain communities where either because of the difficulties in managing flooding, perhaps the cost of insurance, perhaps a severe storm that results in damage in an area will drive reconsideration about development and whether that would be prudent. I think that there will be changes that occur from a variety of influences that will drive, different occupational kind of patterns of the landscape. And it may just be a matter of, affordability, risk and disruption, a combination of things. So I don't think that it's going to be the exact same landscape, certainly in 2060 or 2090 or 2100.
Yeah, well, certainly you're on the case and you're extremely well informed and you've got a great plan. It's very encouraging. And how can our listeners support you in the work you're doing? Is there anything that we can do to help you?
I think it's very important that our leaders, whether they are local or at the state level or at the national level, understand that we don't have the luxury of deferring on this issue. There isn't any debate. communities are impacted today. It's just a matter of whether or not we're willing to accept that dialogue. And for some, maybe it's not convenient. But ultimately, somebody is going to inherit the liability. It'll be the community today, or it's going to be the next generation. And we have to consider the what level of options do we want to leave for those who follow us, and how complex and navigable is that landscape going to be if we don't take aggressive responsibilities today. So demanding support for our federal agencies, the use of climate science in decision-making, support for the National Climate Assessment, those activities are just now ramping up again. The leadership of our and participation of our federal agencies in that process is vital. Communities need that information to support decision-making. Investments in clean energy and clean energy policy, and supporting elected officials as they're getting ready to make potentially some difficult decisions, such in our community about more progressive standards. Elected leaders need to know that they have the backing of their community as they're standing up and making decisions that have longer term implications that may be short term politically not as attractive as another, but it takes great leadership from elected officials to make the types of decisions that are based upon realities of 20 years and not just the next 6 months. And they need to know that the community is behind them.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And it's been, one of the things, I think it was President John F. Kennedy said, a good politician thinks about the next election and a great statesman thinks about the next generation. And it really seems like, given what we're facing right now in South Florida, we need to have great statesmen who are thinking not just about how do I get elected next time, but like you're saying, someone's going to inherit this liability. What can we do now to mitigate the problem, to adapt to the problem, and to do whatever infrastructure changes we need to do to make those areas habitable down the road?
Yes, and I think, too, there's so much to be derived from an economic standpoint. I mean, I think we widely recognize that infrastructure has been underinvested in. If there's opportunities to have cost efficiencies and clean technologies, why wouldn't we take advantage of that? Why wouldn't we want to empower, especially underrepresented communities who may be struggling with the cost of current energy pricing with alternatives that would open up the field? So as a community, as a population, as a nation, there's so much to be gained short-term by leading in these advancements and long-term by shoring up and protecting our communities from risk and losses and hazards and continuing to have robust economies. It's really difficult to understand why any alternative would be debated.
Right, exactly. And if you had 1 minute to talk to the members of Congress and our president, what would you say to them?
Well, I'll have an opportunity tomorrow. On Monday, where there's actually going to be a Senate hearing, a field hearing down here in South Florida with some of our senators and congressional members. And the message that we're delivering is that the time for action has long passed. We don't have the luxury of awaiting another election cycle or a period or opportunity of convenience. The resources have got to be organized now. We are forced to respond to conditions that are already in motion, but at the same time, we have to take the responsibility to try to bracket the magnitude of change that will be occurring long after we are gone. We have to marry those two efforts, and so we're urging continued leadership on clean energy policy and an organization of investments in resilient infrastructure that will benefit our communities now and for the coming decades. And it's a matter of national consequence. It's not pitting one community against another. We are all mutually invested in how we choose to respond as a nation.
That is really well said, and I am hoping with the move now in our current budget to put more money into the national defense and less into the other programs, it sounds to me like the work that you're doing is a critical matter of national defense, and that they should take some of those hundreds of billions of dollars they're using in defense and put it into building resilient communities and developing the renewable energy sources. So that is all the time we have. Jennifer Durato, thank you so much for being with us today, and I really appreciate the great work you're doing there in South Florida. You're wonderful, and I wish you great success.
Eleanor, thank you so much for having me on your program today, and I really appreciate you bringing this audience or this message to the broader audience. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next guest is Shama Viola, a member of the Domenher community in Italy, one of the most successful intentional communities in the world. Shama Viola, welcome to All Together Now.
Hello, Eleanor.
Hello, welcome. Did you just land from Italy now?
No, I've been here a week. I was in Atlanta. I was doing some work in Atlanta, and I'm on my way now to Virginia. I'm halfway to Virginia, between Charlotte and Virginia.
Wonderful. Well, for our listeners who may not know about Domenher, could you please describe the community and kind of what it is? And I should say from the get-go, you know, why I'm having you on the air with me today is that Domenher is one of the intentional communities, and the idea was to create a kind of a model community of how people could live together in harmony and peace. And and it's one of the most successful communities ever put together in the world, and long live. So tell us, please, you know, what is happening at Domenher? What's that community like, and what makes it so special?
What makes it so special is that Domenher is attempting to create a new society. So it's not just a community that thinks about, let's say, education or self-sustenance or spirituality or health and or arts. It's attempting to have all the facets of society present. So it's a 360 degrees type of community. And so the people that are attracted to it, they may be artists, they may be teachers, they may be educators, but they are in an environment where they can express their talents, but it's not just a one direction. It's multifaceted.
Right. And how many people are living there, and where do they come from?
So we have around 550 residents, and these are distributed in various communities. We call these communities nucleo. So we would have maybe 25, 28 type of nucleo. And these are large homes that host from 12 to 24 people, depending on where they are. And in these homes, there are people of all ages and of all type of professions, and they come from all over the world. So although we all speak Italian, many of us also speak other languages so that we can be worldly.
Right, and it's not that you've got 550 people living in one building. It's
No.
Like you're covering a valley, right, a whole area.
Yes, it's around a valley of about 50 kilometers, and we have various nucleus, various communities peppered all over the valley. We have a headquarter, which is in the original land that was bought, that was the original house of the people that 42 years ago actually built Domenher, the founders, a dozen of people that were visionary and really believed, you know, that they could create a community that would be an example in the world. And so this area, this central area, has offices and has guest house and a cafe, medical facility. So we have a headquarters, but our homes are peppered all over the valley and at various distance. So we are actually integrated in the valley that we inhabit. We are not in one compound. We have places very distant from each other. But that's the reason why we have a daily paper, so that we can actually be informed about what everyone else is doing. Because maybe I will not see people that live 15 kilometers from my house, but you know, through the daily paper, we all know what's going on. And then we also have assemblies together where we are all together talking about social issues or you know, things that are happening in Damanhur in that moment and that need to be addressed. So yes, we are a large community, but it's a federation of smaller communities.
And, I see.
Yes.
Yeah, that's great. So that sounds amazing. So you've got a valley, and then you have people. It sounds like they're living in kind of regular houses, or
Yes, there are homes that were
regular homes
long ago. Regular
but that
homes,
they're
but
all
then,
in the same vicinity. But you kind of have some people who are not. That they're spread out throughout the valley.
They're spread out. Yes, and these were homes that maybe a small group bought, and they were able to enlarge to accommodate a larger number of people. In my house, for example, we bought a home that was about 10 years ago, and we enlarged it to accommodate 20 adults and 3 kids, which is as many as we are in my house. So it was a remodeling. It was so we are all... All of us have our own private bedroom, and we have common areas like living room and dining room and kitchen. So we share meals together, we meet, we exchange, but we also have our own private space.
Mm-hmm. That sounds great. And so are there local Italian homes in between all the rest of you, or do you kind of have the whole valley is now all Damanhur?
No. There are many little hamlets, villages, and our nuclear small communities are in many of these villages. So we are integrated with the population of the valley. We are not separate. So one house can be, like in the village where the main the headquarter is, there's maybe 3 or 4 of our nucleus in that village. In the next village is another 3 or 4. In the other village again, there's another 3 or 4. So we are, but they are in the village with all the other people living in the village who do not belong to Damanhur.
Oh, that sounds good. And how are the relations between the members of the Damanhur community and the people who live in the villages who are not members? Is kind of friendly relations, or they kind of look wondering what you're all up to, or how did those relationships go?
In the beginning, when Damanhur was first created, these were people that were coming from outside the valley and were getting a space. And they were seen with suspicion. Who are they? Why they're coming here? And et cetera. And so it took quite a while for the villagers of all the villages where we then took residence to actually trust that we were beneficial to the community as a whole. One of the things that changed their perspective was when we bought an old factory, which was an old Olivetti factory, who were making bags for carriers for portable typewriters. Of course, typewriters went the way of dinosaurs, and the factory closed. And we bought this large factory, and we created a center that has artistic businesses, health facilities, a health food store, just a gallery, and many little businesses that actually are good for the valley, like a hairdresser, things of the sort. So we created a public place, a small mall, for people to come from all over the valley and shop there and do business there. Like we have an insurance company, people come to get insurance. But mostly it's the cafes and the health food store that attract people, and the hairdresser and things of the sort, and the doctors. We have excellent doctors in Zamanur, and they, you know, they're not only for the Manurians, they're there for the public. So we opened up through the valley, showing that we were very much into exchanging with them and that we were open for this exchange. And right now, our cafes are filled with people from the valley, not only from the Manurian, and the doctors are very busy with many, many, many people from the valley, et cetera, et cetera. So things are good. The relationship between us and our neighbors are excellent.
Oh, that sounds great. And, you know, we've got these entrepreneurial business incubators now popping up around the United States, where you encourage different businesses. But it's so great you bought that old factory making typewriters. I remember typewriters. and converting that to the small mall, and then that, you know, having the companies that are helpful to the whole community. So it's great that you're fully integrated that way. I think that is part of what builds the trust and reduces the suspicion, and then people can get along better. So go ahead.
No, just waiting for your question.
Yes, so I'm curious, how long has Damernhur been going? Like, what year was it set up, and who founded it and what was the intention when they set it up?
The intention was to be together and do an experiment in living together. After all, we have been tribal beings since the beginning of humanity, and only in the past 200 years in the we have become much more individualized and nuclear families, more separated with each other, from each other. And we wanted to go back to a more of a tribal condition, but from a perspective of a new approach, not only so that we could help one another and really be in solidarity with each other in supporting, the self-sustenance, like gardening and cultivating our own food, etc. But also in experimenting with many things. We really, in Damernhur, we are researchers, and we research on many levels, some with alternative energies, some in the spiritual arena. We have just are excited about looking to what we can do together, what we can achieve together. And one of our greatest achievements is the Temple of Humankind, a temple dug inside the mountain that is dedicated to humanity, is dedicated to human beings. And it's a gorgeous artistic endeavor that many, many thousands of people come and visit every year. And it's a wonderful example of what a small group of people can do when they have a common aim, a common vision. So, as I said, because we want to be a community, a full circle community, that is our temple, and so we made it beautiful with art and art of all kinds, from paintings to metalwork to mosaics to glasswork. It's very gorgeous. But it's also the same intention that went into building this temple is what drives us to live together, because we want to achieve that same solidarity, that same togetherness in the social level, living harmoniously together, educating our children in a way that they feel free individuals that can make their choices when they grow up. So educating in a broad way, giving them experiences of traveling even all over the world. We send their children traveling very much so that they can enlarge their perspective. And for us, this experiment was to go back into a tribal situation, but in a modern society with modern modalities and with comforts also. Yes, that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
And being an example to others that if we could do it, others could do it.
Exactly. And what year was it founded?
In 1975 we began.
1975. And you mentioned the digging into the mountain there, and that is, you know, first thing I heard about it was this absolutely stunning artwork that was carved out. It was by years, and it was secret originally. But you go into the side of the mountain, and then inside is this absolutely incredible temple. I mean, if it isn't called one of the great wonders of the world, it should be. You know, I've seen the pictures of it are just astounding, what people did kind of carving it out, and it almost looks like it's from another planet. It's just, it's just very beautiful, and each chamber kind of seems to have its own special artistry and feel, and it's just amazing to me that you could do all that digging into the side of a mountain.
Yes. Well, the point was we couldn't do it legally. That's why it was secret. Because in Italy at the time, there was no laws that would support something like that. The law was, even if you have a property, the only thing you can dig is a cellar. And we were not digging a cellar, so we did it in secret. And in the hope of being condoned when it would be found out. And that's what happened. 16 years after building in secret, it was discovered. And it took us 2 years to make sure that the laws could include that we could build more than a cellar. And we got at least 100,000 signatures in Italy to save the temple. And the temple was saved. And luckily, now everybody who wants can come and visit.
That's fantastic, and I hope the Italians understand this is really a national treasure that you've created there. And you yourself are from Italy. How did you find out about the Domenhur community? How long have you been there, and kind of what was it that drew you to moving and becoming a member of that community?
I used to live in California, and I lived in Hawaii. And at a certain point of my living in the States, I decided to go back to Italy to teach, because at the time I was I had found an incredibly wonderful technique called voice dialogue that I found so worthwhile to bring to Italy and teach there. So I went back to Italy to teach this particular therapeutic modality. And while I was there, which was 1992, I was reading a newspaper. And in the newspaper, it was announced that this community has been found in the Piedmont area. They dug a temple into the mountain. Who are they? Why did they do it in secret? It was this big news in the paper. And so I got intrigued. And I would have liked to go and visit. But my travels at the time there in Italy in teaching didn't take me to that region. And it was only 9 years later that I was able to go and spend a couple of days there. Finally, I was able to go back to Italy from Hawaii. And I decided, I'm just going to go for a couple of days and check it out, finally, this this community that had made me curious 9 years ago. And as soon as I went there, I knew inside of me, clear as a bell, that was my next place to live. It was as if I'd been called. It was very clear that I had to come and live there. So I moved, and I went to live there 16 and a half years ago.
Wow, that's quite a story. And so you've been in that community now for 16 years, and do you feel like... you know, you say it was like a calling. You felt like you belonged there. Do you feel now, 16 years later, looking at it, you made the right choice? Do you have any regrets? Is there anything you would have done differently?
Absolutely not, because in Damanhur, everybody is very free to do as they desire. We respect free will more than anything else. And so I've been able to have a foot there and a foot here. Because I'm a teacher, I teach different courses. I'm able to come back to the States. I'm also an American citizen as well as an Italian citizen. So I'm able to come and go and have a foot there and a foot here. And that fulfills my need to not abandon America completely, because I love the country and I love being here. And, you know, it was part of me. And so I love being in Damanhur. And then I love bringing Damanhur here and inspiring people with what we do, with what we achieved, and sharing Damanhur. And that is an exciting life for me. And I'm very, very grateful for that opportunity.
Yeah, well, it sounds like an amazing way to live. And I've heard people talk about the founder. Is his name Falco?
Yes.
Now, did you ever meet him?
Of course. He only died 3.5 years ago.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Yes, so, I was very
yeah,
lucky.
So tell me about him. He sounds like an amazing person.
He was. He was an amazing individual. Very humble, meaning in terms of he would not put himself on a pedestal. So even if you came to visit Damanhur, he would just be walking around and you would not know that he was, you know, the person that we looked for guidance, because he had such a vision of what Damanhur could be, of what the temple could be. He was an amazing individual. He was a writer, a philosopher, a painter, a researcher, and really someone that inspired us. In fact, how could one person inspire so many to come and just build a temple, build a community? It was something about him that empowered us to be our best. And now that he's gone 3.5 years ago, we feel like as if we can walk with our own 2 feet, as if he empowered us to be like, I can say now Damanhur is 42, but we are like teenagers, and teenagers walking on our own 2 feet and finding our own power and really doing the best we can and making the community thrive without a leader, and being ourselves our own masters, our own leaders, and being with each other, creating together, and not looking to someone in specific, but really doing things together.
That's, you know, it's impressive that the whole community has been going since 1975, and that even when the founder has passed away, the community is strong enough. It sounds like, you know, obviously you all must miss him, but that everyone is, as you say, empowered to be your best, and the community seems to be thriving and going strong even without him there.
Exactly. So, and we love changes. And if we make mistakes, then we fix them. We are not afraid to experiment, to keep on looking for new possibilities, new options, new avant-garde modalities to do things. And so it's a very lively, stimulating environment.
Right.
And it's very open to everyone. Anyone can come. Anyone that feels drawn to experience it, they can come for like a short visit, a visit of 1 day, 3 days, 5 days, 7 days, or 10 days, or 3 months. And, you know, there is modalities for everyone.
Right. And what do you think it is about Damanhur community that has made it so long-lasting? You know, they hear about so many communities forming, but then they have, you know, internal fighting, or the founder is no longer there and it falls apart. What is it about Domenher that's made it so successful for so long?
For us, to me, it's like a number of things. For us, is that we are all having the same goal, to create a community that is an example, that is thriving, that is successful, and that is successful not only out there in the world, but for us individually, where we are happy, where we can fulfill our own personal mission, personal goals. So Domenher is allowing each individual to choose their own lives and then to contribute to the community through their own individual modalities. And so this makes it, the Domenher has a lot of variety. And so each individual is free to express themselves. That makes it so that we are like close to 600 individuals who are very diverse and very united. So we are so different, but we are united in the same goal, in the same vision, in the same objective. And so one of the things that we recognize is the richness of diversity. So we have many people from many different countries, different languages, different cultures. And these diversities, we see them as a wealth for us, something to learn from, something that we can use to enrich the community. And so that is a main ingredient. And for us, like having a common goal, because having visions that are bigger than you, so that you don't reach them very easily and you can keep on going towards it. And Falco used to say that we were very good at reaching the impossible dream, that when we were going for the regular dreams, we were kind of failing. We were just good at impossible, making the impossible possible.
So that's fantastic, and that's all the time we have, but it's so inspiring to hear about you and the wonderful community at Domenher, Italy. Shama Viola, thank you so very much for being with us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Eleanor.
In case you've missed any of our programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.